Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Hob and Hound Pub by Shauna Kelly, narrated by Samantha Dez. 1. City of Lights and Shadows. Paris is my new favorite city. Granted, I haven't been many places, but still, I'd thought we were headed straight for England. Instead, we flew into the City of Lights. Aldith, Letitia's mother and the woman who had declared war against Clive almost 1,000 years ago, was in England. We needed to skewer the heart of the Hydra, or more vamps would be coming for us. And we would, soon, but not now. I had to admit, this whole marriage thing was kind of embarrassing, but also sort of amazing. I felt like an idiot referring to Clive as my husband. But then the giddy bubbled up and I found myself grinning for no particular reason. Like now, when we were strolling hand in hand around a glowing glass pyramid between fountains at the entrance to the Louvre. Although, I supposed being at the Louvre was reason enough. I stopped at one of the smaller glass pyramids to look down into the museum. I had to keep pinching myself. I was in Paris. It was after hours, but Clive knew a way in. One Remy, his French vampire friend, said still worked. The expansive high Baroque palace surrounded a vast courtyard on three sides. Clive walked us away from the lights toward a shadowy corner between the Richelieu and Sully wings. Once the immediate area had cleared out, Clive swung me around so I was clinging to his back and then scaled the wall to the roof. We jogged along a narrow metal beam between the stone facade of the building and the glass-domed roof. I followed, not looking down, as heights were not my friend. Clive ducked behind a statue and circled to the back of the gorgeously ornate attic in the center pavilion of the wing.
"The last time I was here," he whispered, "these were government offices. The finance department, as I recall."
He took my hand and led me to an ornamental hexagonal medallion. It appeared fixed in place, and yet when he pushed it, it swung in.
"The Louvre used to be just that one long wing."
He pointed to the building opposite us across the courtyard.
"Remy said this wing was gutted and remodeled to expand the museum."
His grin flashed in the darkness.
"Let's take a look."
He sat on the lip of the opening, his legs dangling into the darkened hall below.
"No heartbeat. The guard is elsewhere."
He pulled me onto his lap, my legs swinging into the void beside his own, his arm tight around my middle. A moment later, we were dropping 40 feet. Clive took the impact before he loosened his grip and my boots hit the polished floor. I looked up at the open panel, a tiny piece of starlit sky visible.
"You left the hatch open," I whispered.
"All the doors are alarmed. That's how we're getting out. Now, where to first?"
He took my hand and we strolled down the airy halls, pausing to study paintings and sculptures. I knew there were guards walking the museum with us, but Clive's sensitivity to heartbeats meant he heard them coming long before they appeared, giving us time to move on or hide. We wandered for hours, only seeing a small portion of the enormous collection. It felt almost religious, this realization over and over of the greatness, the near divinity of some. We all leave our fingerprints on the world to greater and lesser degrees, but some have created art so remarkable that tens of thousands flock to experience it daily. It was staggering. I enjoyed the surprises, too. The Mona Lisa was small and roped off to keep visitors far away. Clive and I didn't want to trip any silent alarms, so we stayed behind the lines. It was intriguing, if a little underwhelming. The Winged Victory sculpture, however, was magnificent. She stood atop a staircase in a large open hall, an artery for other galleries and floors, easily seen by guards entering from every direction. I couldn't tear my eyes from her. Power, glory, confidence. She awed and inspired me. I wanted to hold her essence deep within, to call upon it in moments of darkness and fear.
I was studying the marble statue 1 minute, the folds and movement of her skirt, the detail and lift of each feather in her wings, when I was picked up and raced down multiple halls, turning this way and that. When Clive finally put me down, we were standing in front of Botticelli's Venus and the Three Graces presenting gifts to a young woman. "What the heck?" I whispered.
Gods from different sectors were all about to convert on that hall. We have a little time before the god for this sector returns.
He pointed to the painting.
And I thought you'd enjoy this one.
Moving in closer, I tried to take in the fresco. The soft colors, the delicate beauty of the woman in her billowing robes. The age and cracking of the plaster did nothing to diminish the beauty. If anything, it lent to it. Turning to Clive, I said, "And you were around when this was first painted." It hit me at the oddest moments. My new husband was ancient. 1,000 being the new 30, if you were a vampire. He quirked an eyebrow at me.
"Problem?"
I shook my head and shrugged, turning back to the fresco. "Decrepitude looks good on you." I just leaned in to study the bride's features when I was snatched up, thrown over his shoulder, and carried down darkened passages again. When my feet hit the floor, we were tucked away in a shadowy corner, away from the art. Clive's mouth was at my neck, his hands dragging down my body.
"Decrepit?"
His lips skimmed my jaw. "Elderly," I gasped when he nibbled my earlobe.
"Infirm."
One of his hands snaked up my sweater and palmed a breast. Breath uneven, I added, "Frail." The last word ended on a moan as he unzipped my jeans and slid his other hand into my panties. Clive took my mouth to muffle the sounds I was making, his hands and lips working me over like a virtuoso. I crushed him to me as I flew apart. Panting, resting my head against the wall, I tried to recover. My knees almost buckled when he did some kind of secret vampy finger twirl as he slid out. He leaned in, his lips hovering an inch from mine.
"Decrepit?"
"Doddering." I re-zipped my jeans with shaky hands.
"That's it."
And just like that, I was picked up and we were racing down darkened halls again. Giggling silently, I smacked his butt. "I want to see the Egyptians before we go." A few minutes later, I was put down again, my hand on the crook of Clive's arm as we walked through the gallery holding Egyptian antiquities. Display cases held sculptures, jars, jewelry. Some pieces towered over us. Some were kept safely behind glass. I studied hieroglyphs longer than I should have, as I had no idea how to read them, but the idea that a story was being told drew me in. Rows of sarcophagi were lined up in a case, some gorgeously painted inside and out, others without decoration, save for the faces carved at the top, the etchings on the chest. They were, each of them, extraordinary art. Sometimes it made my head hurt to think I was looking at pieces fashioned by hand 4,000 years ago. "Hey, do you know any Egyptians?" Clive was studying a small cat sculpture with ruby eyes.
"Of course.
I mean, ones who were alive in ancient Egypt." Straightening, he turned to me.
"Yes, well, one, really."
"And let me guess, you dated." I rolled my eyes and kept walking. Catching my hand in his, he walked with me.
"Actually, no. He's quite striking, but not my type."
He twisted our hands so the blue diamond in my wedding ring glinted in the low light.
"For some unknown reason, my type seems to be bookish bartenders who give me far too much lip."
I spun him around and kissed him soundly.
"You mean like that?"
His eyes had gone vamp black, so I knew I was a heartbeat from being thrown over his shoulder and taken back to the hotel, which, granted, any other night would have been mind-blowing. But I wasn't done. I extricated myself from his arms and went in search of a mummy. I was sure they had one here. Perhaps my necromantic abilities were on overdrive in this gallery, but it was almost like I felt him calling to me, waiting behind a row of sphinxes. Like the Mona Lisa, he was much smaller than I was expecting. Nothing like the mummies described in books or depicted on film. Linen strips had been woven in a geometric pattern over his face. He also had a hand-painted chest piece, neckband, and apron laying over the linen wrappings.
Nenu, I breathed.
Hmm?
His name was Nenu, and he was loved. Someone had taken painstaking hours to weave his wrappings as they had. Someone who grieved his loss. I was stepping away when I saw movement out of the corner of my eye.
Nenu's faceless head had turned toward me, the fingers of one hand twitching.
Shit!
Just to be clear, I did not read from the book. Yes, most of my mummy knowledge came from a movie. What's your point? Clive had his head tilted toward the arched entrance of the hall, listening.
You didn't what?
He asked absently. Clive? When he turned, he found my shaking finger pointing at a mummy, one who now showed movement in both hands. His eyes widened.
Oh, good lord.
We both watched in horror as an arm moved, causing the neckband to slide off and into the side of the glass box.
Fix it, darling. Now, we are not setting a mummy loose in Paris. Will never be allowed to return.
Nudging me, he stood transfixed.
I don't know how to...
The head lifted an inch and then dropped.
Figure it out, and hurry. The guard is coming back.
I closed my eyes and sought out the dead. Not all of them, just the one right in front of me.
Rest, Nenu. Your time on this earth is done. Return to Osiris. Go.
I pushed on the last word and felt his spirit leave this realm.
A bit of a time crunch, my love.
Done. Clive snatched me up and raced us through the halls, eventually stopping where we started. I looked up into the hole in the ceiling. It looked impossibly far away. Clive adjusted his hold on me, so I was clinging to his back, my arms around his neck.
Hold on,
he said, patting my wrist. When he flexed his knees to jump, I said, no way. He leapt straight up, catching the lip of the opening.
Climb up and out, ye of little faith.
I scrambled up his body and out the hexagonal opening in the dome. Once I was back on the roof, Clive pulled himself through and pushed the decorative panel back in place. Grinning at me in the dark, he asked,
what shall we do next?
2. Should a hotel room be bigger than a house? I woke, snuggled up against my bridegroom in the pitch-black bedroom of the George V penthouse. Apparently, if you spend enough, and I didn't want to know how much this place cost because I was pretty sure it was more than I made in a year, you can ask them to put up blackout curtains to help you sleep, or, in Clive's case, not to be turned to ash by the sun. We'd been in Paris 2 nights, and I was in love with the city. It felt like Paris was America's sophisticated thrice-divorced aunt who smoked too much, drank only wine, and stayed runway thin by taking rare bites of the world-renowned meals she ordered. She was a total hoot to visit. You learned new swear words and flirted with her handsome neighbor who was far too old for you. Somewhere between the cigarettes, the wine, and the brie, though, you'd grown. Become more cultured. I didn't want to leave here, but I felt like some of the green had been rubbed off just by visiting. Yesterday, I'd only woken an hour or so before nightfall, so I'd lounged in the sumptuous living room to wait for Clive. Today, though, I had a few hours. Time to explore on my own. Dressed in my running gear, I took the elevator down, crossed the elegant lobby trimmed for the holidays, and hit the streets of Paris. Clive had sent Russell and Godfrey on to England to do some reconnaissance and secure accommodations. I knew I should be grateful that Cadmail, an ancient Mayan warrior and Clive's vampy friend, was watching over the San Francisco Nocturne in our absence. But I hadn't yet forgiven him for rummaging around in my head. Hypocritical given my abilities, I know. With Abigail, my homicidal aunt, and Letitia, Clive's psycho stalker, both gone, San Francisco was the safest it had been in quite a while, so I wasn't too worried about leaving my slaughtered lamb in Owen and Dave's capable hands. Okay, I was a little worried, but it was mostly centered on Steno and her sisters permanently scaring away my customers. At first, my run, like my thoughts, meandered, no destination in mind, as I soaked up the sights and sounds of Paris. As I made my way through the Tuileries, though, I realized I was running toward something. Sunlight glittered off the glass pyramid standing before the Louvre. I wanted to go back to see something that had barely registered as we'd raced past, but had lingered in my mind's eye. Ignoring the long line at the main entrance, I instead went to the Richelieu door, waiting only 10 minutes instead of an hour. I looked up the location of the sculpture on a map. It was in Denun, the wing opposite to the one I was standing in. The museum was, of course, crowded, so I weaved in and out of meandering groups of visitors, slowly making my way through the seemingly endless halls. Wanting to be there when Clive awoke, I knew I wouldn't have much time. The idea of going back without finding it, though, made me feel unsteady. Finally, after dodging a large student group, I made it to a long hall showcasing an array of sculptures. The one I wanted was at the end. Psyche revived by Cupid's kiss. A half dozen people were standing around the sculpture and taking pictures. I moved to the side, out of the constantly shifting streams of visitors. I tuned out the talking, the complaints about sore feet and boredom, the flash photography, which was prohibited by the Louvre but ignored by the tourists, focusing instead on the marble figures. Psyche reclined, forever reaching up to encircle Cupid as he gazed down, tenderly holding her, as though painfully aware of just how fragile she was, how fragile their love was. I knew the stories, knew their plight, the distrust, the trials, and yet love had prevailed. Canova, the sculptor, had captured a moment of perfect longing, a moment bursting with anticipation where the world had contracted to two people and the promise of a kiss. "All right, dear," I startled at the soft Italian voice. Turning, I found an elderly woman at my elbow, her expression one of concern. "Yes, of course," I said, clearing my throat. "You're crying." She looked back at the piece. "Lovely, yes?" Scrubbing the wetness from my face, I nodded. "Yes." Her family gathered her up and herded her on to the next hall, but not before she turned and nodded to me, recognizing another like herself who could drop under the noise and chaos of the moment to experience the eternal. I returned her nod as she moved through the arch. Cupid and Clive bore no resemblance. In the stories, he was too beautiful to look at, which fit, but the sculptural version was softer and more angelic. What touched me, made me weep in recognition, was the love clear in his aspect, the tenderness with which he held her. I identified with Psyche, who appeared to have been through more than she could handle. She was exhausted and ready to give up. And yet, she forever lifted her arms in trembling hope and love. "There you are." I knew that voice. Turning, I wrapped my arms around him and burrowed in. "I missed you." "Here I am." He squeezed me to him. "I know, but the missing takes time to fade."
"True."
He kissed the top of my head.
"When I awoke, you weren't there, but strangely, this statue was on my mind. It was almost like a muddied memory from a dream, but I don't dream anymore. So, wanting to find you, I went in search of the lovers, and here you are."
I smiled into his neck, his scent settling something jittering inside me. "You could have just called."
"You mean on this?"
he said, pulling my phone from his pocket.
"You left it charging by the bed."
Grimacing, I took it from him and slid it into my hoodie pocket. "Oops. I intended to go for a quick run through the city and be back before you woke. It's just, I moved so we could both gaze at the statue. I couldn't get this out of my head. We raced past it last night, and I wanted to see it again. Glancing up at the clock on the wall, I paused, unable to make sense of it. I'd been standing here for over an hour.
I imagine you're hungry. Shall we return to the hotel so you can change before we go to dinner?
He ran his hand up and down my back. Would you mind if we didn't do fancy tonight?
Not at all. What did you have in mind?
He took my hand and we wove our way through groups of stragglers who were deciding where to go when the museum shortly closed. I thought a moment. A leisurely stroll and a cafe that appeals?
Sounds perfect,
he said, squeezing my hand. Once out the main doors and walking across the courtyard, Clive put his arm around me and began the stroll. We walked along the Seine, streetlights dotting the darkening sky. Restaurants and clubs glowed invitingly on both sides of the river. We made it back to the hotel in no time. After showering and dressing, I almost changed my mind, opting to order room service and eat on our balcony overlooking the city. Almost. I didn't want to miss a moment of Paris before we resumed our hunt for Aldith. Wearing jeans, boots, a cranberry sweater in a nod to the season, and the long, warm black cashmere sweater coat Clive had bought for me the night before, I checked my reflection. No braids tonight. I wore my hair long. Clive waited by the door in a charcoal gray overcoat. Vampires weren't bothered by the cold, but he knew how to blend. Sometimes I was struck all at once by my good fortune. Clive had been born almost 1,000 years ago on another continent, and yet we'd met and fallen in love. This gorgeous, kind, clever, fiercely protective man was mine. All the days of our very long lives, we'd said when we'd taken our vows. Until I breathed my last, until he was dust on the wind, we'd have each other. The thought stole my breath. Clive would be my partner in crime for all time. I went to him, wrapped my arms around his neck, and kissed him senseless. When I tried to step back, I found I couldn't move. Clive's hands on my butt held me in place. I looked up into vamp black eyes and kissed his chin. Just making sure you knew I loved you and was looking forward to forever with you. Palming my butt, he hitched me up around his waist and walked us back to the bedroom.
We'll be making a later start this evening.
I was giggling when he tossed me onto the soft bed. Considerably later, we were dressed and ready to go again. This time, though, I was famished. First order of the evening is food, I said as we took the small elevator down to the lobby.
We could have ordered room service,
Clive said as he lifted my hand, kissing my fingers. Nope, I want to see as much of Paris as possible before we have to leave. A doorman held one of the large double doors open for us, nodding respectfully as we passed. Bonsoir, I called back, grateful for the long sweater coat. A late December night in Paris was quite cold. I thought it snowed in Paris. Clive tucked my hand into the crook of his arm.
It does, but not this soon. The air isn't freezing yet. As I recall, it's January into February when the snow falls.
Paris was all dressed up for the holidays. Wreaths hung on doors, fairy lights twinkled in denuded trees, storefronts sparkled, bridges across the Seine glowed. I wanted nothing more than to be in the moment. But my stomach started growling. Clive placed his hand over mine, leading me down a side street.
I know just the place.
We turned again and were on a narrow street where festive lights glittering in windows were dimmed by the warm glow pouring from a restaurant. It was like a Van Gogh painting come to life. Overlapping voices, clinking glasses, a violin playing. It was perfect. Clive spoke to the hostess in fluent French. A moment later, the young woman led us to a sidewalk table. Most sat inside, but a few, like ourselves, didn't want to be tucked away. The meal was amazing. Both meals. Clive and I had our moves down. He played with his food, occasionally taking what looked like a bite while I ate mine. Then we switched plates. Being relatively alone meant we didn't have to be quite so clandestine with our maneuvers. An older woman walked out of the restaurant and said something in French to us. Clive chuckled, taking my hand before responding. I caught "my wife and American," but that was about it. The woman nodded, adjusting the thick scarf at her neck. She patted my hand and said something to me. Clive thanked her, I got that much, and then she walked across the street and up the short stairs of an apartment building. I turned to him, waiting. He squeezed my hand.
She was sitting in the window and noticed our rooms. She wondered if you were pregnant. I told her we were newly married and you were not, although I don't think she believed me.
What about at the end, when she patted my hand?
Oh, it sounded like some kind of blessing for being fruitful and multiplying,
he said, lifting a finger toward our waiter for the check. Aw, that was sweet, assuming we wanted to multiply, or could. I glanced up when a corner window on the third floor lit up. Hopefully that meant she'd made it to her apartment. She had a little buzz.
Hmm?
Clive placed cash in the red leather folder the waiter had dropped on our table.
Are you ready? And what kind of buzz?
Yeah. I took his hand and we continued our stroll through the city. I don't know. It wasn't witchy or vampy.
That word.
But there was some little buzz of power in her touch. I shrugged. Or maybe she shuffles her feet and builds up a static charge. He pulled my hand back into the crook of his arm, his preferred strolling position.
I didn't sense anything.
Shrugging, I snuggled in. No idea, it wasn't strong. She may not even know she has magical blood. When we passed under a metro sign, I stopped and pointed up.
Oh, darling, must we? Not all Parisian experiences are good ones.
At my continued tugging, he gave in, and we walked down the steps to the subway trains. My necromantic spidey senses were tingling. Lots of dead down here. Old, though, not recent. Well, one recent, down the white-tiled tunnel to the left. When I paused, looking around for someone to tell, Clive pulled me along.
I can hear the authorities. They found him.
He led me to a large, colorful metro map.
Where would you like to go?
Our time was short in Paris. What did I want to see before we left? I pointed to a spot in the 14th arrondissement. Clive looked pained.
Must we?
I merely grinned in response. He shook his head, took my hand, and led me through the tunnels to the correct platform. Ever since I'd learned about them, I'd wanted to visit the catacombs of Paris. 3. And you call yourself a vampire.
If we don't find an evening tour, they're most likely closed until morning. And wouldn't that be a shame?
I elbowed him. So you can get into the Louvre after hours, but not a catacomb? What kind of vampire are you?
One with standards, darling.
It's our honeymoon. We could go dancing at L'Arc, perhaps take a cruise along the Seine. Ooh, I heard about a moving bus discotheque. All the benches were removed to make a dance floor. We could dance while seeing the sights. Win-win.
Pass, pass.
The sound of a train approaching echoed off the tiled walls, creating a deafening roar.
If my choices are dancing in a moving vehicle or the dead.
He shrugged, put an arm around me, and led me into the half-filled train car. Most passengers appeared to be heading home from work or going out for the evening. Clive tucked me in front of himself, wrapped an arm around me, and grabbed a pole by the door. When the train left the station, we began to rock back and forth with the motion of the car. I rested my head against Clive's shoulder, and people watched.
Give us a kiss, love,
Clive whispered in my ear. Grinning, I turned, slid my hands under his overcoat, and then gave him a soft kiss before tucking my head in the crook of his neck. Clive held fast to the metal pole while I held fast to him.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?